Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we take a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter @takingstocknt. Now, we're going to place special focus today on the issues of climate change, the environment and corporate sustainability. Even before the current COVID crisis hit us, corporate sustainability was viewed as one of the greatest transformational trends for the global economy and for individual businesses. One of the people helping to lead that change is David Blood. He set up the Sustainable Investment Fund, Generation Investment, back in 2004, with one of his co-founders, former US Vice President Al Gore. I met David in London earlier this year, just as the current pandemic was emerging across the globe. We spoke about a number of issues, including ESG, or environmental, social and governance factors, involved in considering an investment, and also about the emergence of corporate sustainability as a significant driver of business and investment. I first asked him why he had started his firm over 15 years ago.
We set up the firm really for two purposes, actually. The first was we wanted to be an excellent, hopefully, investment manager for our clients. And so we had a client-first orientation from the very beginning, and we can talk about what that meant and does mean. And secondly, we wanted to be advocates of sustainability and sustainable capitalism, sustainability, sustainable investing in capital markets. From the very beginning, we agreed that 5% of our profits would be allocated to the Generation Foundation to promote sustainability in capital markets. And we agreed that we would be advocates with our clients, advocates with others around sustainability and sustainable investing. And so the firm is both a commercial business, as you would expect it to be as an investment management firm, but we're also a mission-driven firm. We're a B Corp. Our people work here principally because they want to do both. And in fact, they recognize that the investment performance that we've been able to deliver for our clients gives us some credibility as advocates for sustainability. So it's truly interlinked in every way, shape, and form. But you should think of us as both a commercial business and a mission-driven organization.
Now, most of us know about Vice President Gore's track record in this whole area, going back quite a while. But I suppose in the early 2000s, when the firm was established, you were effectively pioneers in this area of sustainability, weren't you?
Well, we were certainly early. There were others who had been at this for a while, principally what was known at the time as socially responsible investing, ethical investing. There was the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. There were a number of important fund managers who had been thinking about socially responsible investing, both from an investing and a research perspective. But from a mainstream perspective, it wasn't really thought about. In fact, I would say if you looked at the entire equity market, it would be more or less sort of 1% of the market. My partners at Goldman Sachs were admittedly a bit surprised that I made the decision to retire from Goldman Sachs to help set up a boutique fund management firm focused on sustainability. But the journey was a long time coming. The recognition that sustainability was driving economies was well known even in the early 2000s. And importantly, we, through our own investment experience and business experience, recognized that environmental and social governance factors were tools to help us understand what a company did and how a company did it, and we thought would help us be better investors. And so the combination of being long-term, the commitment to sustainability or the recognition that sustainability was driving economies and would increasingly drive economies, and ESG as a tool, we felt that that was an investment framework that would allow us to deliver better investment results for our clients.
In broad terms, from the very start, how do you define sustainability when in investment terms, in capital markets terms?
Well, it's very broad, actually, and it's a very important question. So oftentimes, particularly generation, we're thought of as sort of an environmental firm. And indeed, we have a real focus on the environment, on climate change, on the broader challenges of a transition to a no-carbon economy. But we've also recognized from the very beginning, in fact, my own personal interest was in poverty and development and social justice. And we recognized really from the very beginning that these issues were basically two sides of the same coin. And we, from the very beginning, integrated a very holistic approach to thinking about sustainability, ranging from the environment to climate change, to water, to migration, to health, to poverty, inequality, social justice, and governance. So for us, it's really the whole array of challenges. And when you think about it and say it in that sort of line of words, you recognize that it really does drive the economies of the world, and increasingly so. And it's a mistake to think of them in isolation because they're so interlinked.
You're 15, 16 years on the go. ESG, sustainability, has become almost a buzzword, a fashionable term now in the whole investment community. What do you feel about that? The likes of Larry Fink writing out to chief executives from BlackRock in January, basically saying that the financial world is changing. Do you believe that that awareness is increasing, or is there an element of fashion about it?
Well, first of all, we appreciate the recognition that Larry has put forward in his letter. We know that they're serious about it, actually. We know very well the work that's gone into that proposition or that pronouncement. We're glad that the people are now declaring sustainability as mainstream. That was our objective 16 years ago. But we also recognize that there's a long ways to go. There's a long ways to go because the rigor of sustainability, I think, is not as well appreciated as it will be. There are trade-offs in understanding sustainability and deploying capital in that respect. That will get harder as we move through this transition to a no-carbon economy. And we must insist on increasing the rigor of sustainability and ESG. It would be tragic if, as people got into the market or began to say, yes, we're going to use sustainability and ESG, if we began to move towards the lowest common denominator. We can't do that. You'll lose the rigor and the insights of sustainability and ESG if that's what you do. And secondly, it would absolutely not result in the outcomes we need, which is we need to drive to a no-carbon economy, we need to drive towards a fairer transition, a fairer economy, and we need to do that in the next 5 to 10 years. And we can't be sort of doing it on an incremental basis. We have to do it on a transformational basis. And therefore, as investors, we have to think much more rigorously and farsightedly to make this transition. So those who are signing up for sustainability, we welcome you for sure. It is mainstream. It's best practice, but it's hard. And we need to be sure that people are recognizing the importance of rigor and deep research.
And how do you protect that rigor that you have established over time? How do you protect against box ticking, against greenwashing, or whatever you call it?
Well, it's a good question. And what we're trying to do is help be part of that debate, share some of our experiences. There are a number of research organizations who are trying to develop better insight. The Sustainability Accounting Board is an example. The TCFD, the Task Force on Climate Change Disclosure, is another example. So helping to work with these organizations who are bringing the Climate Disclosure Project, CDP, these are all organizations, Principles Responsible Investing, these are all organizations that are collectively trying to bring rigor to the transition to a no-carbon economy and sustainability as a mainstream.
How do you actually assess what businesses to invest in, and how do you audit how sustainable they are? I mean, what sort of tools do you use?
Well, that is increasingly a critical question, really, for the same reasons we were just talking about. As you start talking about sustainability in ESG, your next step on that train of thought is impact, and therefore reporting on impact. And right now, I would say our journey, not only generations, but the industry, is in the very, very early days, early beginnings. There is increasing rigor around it. The IFC has private equity standards. There's the Impact Reporting Project. that is being led by a number of folks here in London, and there's a series of others, actually, SASB, as I mentioned earlier. These are initiatives that will help us better disclose, TCFD is as it relates to climate, will help us better disclose and therefore better measure the impact of the portfolios that we're all collectively allocating capital to. But it's critical. If we, particularly for investors who will increasingly recognize that investment should be evaluated on risk, return, and impact, those investors, and I believe actually almost all investors will get to that point over the next 5 to 10 years, those investors will require fund managers like Generation to be very clear on its impact and report on that impact and probably, frankly, invest with impact as an objective.
And do you and others need to be increasingly proactive, indeed perhaps aggressive, with the companies and industries that you invest in?
Yes, we need to be much more engaged, although I think Generation has always thought of that as this fiduciary duty. But I must tell you that on balance, I think most of the very best businesses are already onto this. Most of the what I would consider to be the very best CEOs or finance directors are driving their business strategy around sustainability. And so pushing them are probably not as important as, frankly, pushing the asset owner community and the asset management community to recognize the importance of sustainability. So I guess I would say I think businesses are onto it because they recognize it as best practice. It allows them to drive revenues, profitability, and competitive positioning in a very strategic long-term way. And whether you call it sustainability or not, they know that. Particularly the transition to a no-carbon economy will be the most significant economic transition in history. Many CEOs, many business leaders, many entrepreneurs know that. And so they're building their businesses around it. And we in the investment community need to catch up, actually.
You say that a lot of the best businesses are onto it. But do you think generally, whether it's business, society in general, politicians, governments, do you think they are sufficiently aware of that transformational urgency you talked about?
I think businesses are more aware than the politicians, and business is more aware of probably the investment community. I think they're at the coalface, and so they're, which is an ironic word to be using as it relates to climate change, but they recognize the economic opportunity, and this will be the most significant economic opportunity probably in history and certainly in our professional lifetimes. And so the best entrepreneurs and business leaders get that. I think the politicians are a little slower on that. I think consumers, by the way, are helping drive this change. Just thinking about the trend to veganism, the mobility changing, consumer preferences changing. So I do think business is ahead of the game. But to your other question, no, I don't think we fully recognize the urgency of the challenge. We have made huge progress over the last 10 years. If we make 2x of that progress, we will not achieve the Paris climate objectives of limiting global warming to less or 1.5 degrees C or less, preferably. And we'll probably not achieve 2 degrees C for that matter. And so we're going to have to fundamentally change everything we've done today, and we're going to have to do it very quickly. And people don't yet appreciate that, but I think they will. And I think that they will in a much faster way than the markets may anticipate, a much faster way than politicians may anticipate, and I think we'll see it in the next 2, 3, 5 years. There's an old expression is that sometimes things take longer than you think they would, but move more quickly than you think they could. I think that's exactly what will happen here.
That urgency, that transformational urgency, is that going to impact how Generation itself actually behaves in the sense that I assume you take flights around the world to conferences and to meet clients? And do you think that sort of everyday behavior and activity is going to have to change for people like yourselves as well, who are very focused on sustainability?
It'll have to change. Every one of us will have to change. It already is. It's already changing. And that's obviously a good thing. Now, change isn't always bad. Change can actually be extremely good. And we believe that this transformation, there will be, unfortunately, losers. We have to ensure that communities in particular are protected and that we find ways to allocate funding to communities that are potentially left behind. But the economic opportunity to transform our economy is huge. and the possibilities of different ways of living, different ways of communicating, being at home more frequently. These are good outcomes, actually. But we're going to have to think more creatively than we have in the past. And that goes for generation just as much as goes for your good self.
Are there sectors you will not invest in?
We have historically not invested in the hydrocarbons industry. We haven't owned a hydrocarbon security for a decade, actually. There are a series of other industries that we find difficult to figure out, and so we don't invest in them. But we're generally looking for businesses that are going to be part of the transition to a sustainable economy, part of businesses that will drive towards a clean, fair, healthy, safe, no-carbon economy.
How active or proactive is your chairman, Vice President Al Gore, and is he still an incredibly powerful ambassador for what we all need to do?
Well, certainly Al has been an amazing partner. He is an active chairperson, just in the traditional sort of European sense, where the chair is actively involved in business. And in fact, when I met Al, first of all, I actually had no intention of asking him to become our partner. But we recognized that we were trying to do the same thing, and our skills were complementary. But most importantly, he's really smart and a really nice guy, and we've been able to, I think, along with the other founding partners, and indeed all sort of 90 of us, I think, build a really interesting and important team, and Al's just an important part of that. We did not ask him to join us, by the way, to be a door opener. We have those skills, and we think investment performance helps open doors as well.
And you resisted the temptation to call yourselves Blood and Gore.
We did, although he did not want to do that. He wanted to absolutely call the firm Blood and Gore. It was the rest of us that thought it was a bad idea. Well, maybe not me, but the rest of them.
Broadly speaking, and I know Generation invests and looks out for innovation in the whole sustainability area, including energy usage, are you broadly optimistic that as a people, as a society, we can address this major, probably the biggest challenge the human race has faced in many ways globally, that we can address it, that we can come up with technological and other solutions for it in time?
Yes. Categorically, yes. If you wanted to be depressed, you could do. There are plenty of bits of bad news that one reads every single day that might cause you to be concerned. But the technology exists. Human ingenuity exists. The urgency is clear. And people ultimately tend to get to do the right thing. And we're confident that we can get to the right place. We're going to have to move much more quickly than we are now. But when you look back on history, even recent history, when the world faces catastrophic crisis, we tend to get our act together. And we believe that that will happen here too.
On that optimistic note, we leave it there. David Blood, Senior Partner at Generation Investment Management, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
We'll hear next from Lucas Chancel, co-director of the World Inequality Lab at the Paris School of Economics. He's also a senior research fellow at the Institute for Sustainable Development and International Relations and author of Unsustainable Inequalities, Social Justice and the Environment. Lucas, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, this book, Lucas, addresses, I suppose, one of the greatest challenges for the world in general and for individual countries, how to drive change, which we all know is needed, change in climate policy and environmental policy, without at the same time widening a lot of the social inequality that already exists there. And you wrote the book just before COVID-19 hit the world. But as you note, subsequently, COVID-19 itself is a form of environmental shock. And the last 7 or 8 months has actually seen global inequality even widen further.
Absolutely. The main messages of the book, I think, are in fact reinforced by the kind of events that we've been facing over the past months. The COVID crisis is very likely to be, you know, induced by some environmental changes. You change, you know, natural habitats, and this releases certain viruses into human populations. And then you have this, you know, massive pandemic that hits countries in different ways, but in most countries where we have done some studies and we have preliminary information on the impact this has on inequality, we see that, you know, the COVID is exacerbating all forms of inequalities between blue collars and white collars, between men and women, between people of different ethnic groups, those who are generally at the bottom of the social ladder fare even worse when the COVID hits. Why? Well, when we're interested in environmental change and in other forms of environmental shocks or disasters, we have, you know, bits of the explanation. When you look at hurricanes, when you look at floods, when you look at droughts, this is a pattern that you often see. The pattern being that these shocks are exacerbating social inequalities in societies. Why? Because it is often the case that those who are the worst off are also more exposed to these shocks. This was very true in the context of COVID and all, you know, the blue collar workers having to go to work in many countries while the white collars, you know, the intellectual professions, those who earn quite a bit of income could work from home. So difference in exposure to the risk. But then there's another effect, which is also very important. Those who are at the bottom of the social ladder, they also have less resources to fight the virus, as well as they have less resources if they have to face floods or droughts or a hurricane that hits their home. They have nothing in their bank account to rebuild their home. They often generally have little access to hospital, little access to several forms of social help in several countries. So, you know, this general pattern of more inequality associated to environmental degradation is something that we start to know about that. Now, the question I'm asking in the book is, how do we break this vicious circle?
Yeah, and you write that the 2012 United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio de Janeiro was the first major global forum where the very strong linkages between trying to change climate and being cognizant of the social environment and social changes were brought together. And one of the first ways that conference and your book points out to try to address this whole issue is to measure first, to measure and map who and what exactly is causing most of the pollution at the moment.
Absolutely. I think, you know, this conference, and I think it's also important to be critical of these big UN conferences and to look at them, you know, understanding their strengths and their limits. And often we can be very disappointed by the work of, you know, international organizations when it comes to really stopping climate change and to making the world go better and stopping wars. And there are obvious limitations to, you know, international multilateralism, especially today. But there are also important outcomes of these, you know, global conferences where all countries meet and try to define what's the agenda, what's going to be important in the decades to come. And what I argue is that in 2015, when all the world nations agreed to the Sustainable Development Goals, this was extremely innovative and important because for the first time, we were thinking about environmental policies, environmental issues in an integrated manner along with social issues. And before that, whether in global forums or also at the national level within each and every country, we were used to separate these issues. We're going to talk about the environment on the one hand, and then there are some other social issues to be solved on the other. And for the first time, the Sustainable Development Goals really try to think of these two issues, these two problems, as two halves of the same walnut. And it's not just about, you know, the problem, it's also about the solutions. And thinking about these two dimensions in an integrated manner is also one way, one step towards, you know, solutionizing the problems, solving the problem.
You write that the performance of the world and individual countries has been very patchy since then in actually measuring who exactly are the greatest villains in terms of carbon pollution and social divergence, but that it's pretty clear that those with most wealth are doing so.
Yeah, so, and to come back on your previous point, so when you start to think about these issues together, then you are on the right track to develop, you know, the proper tools for analyzing and for actually getting the job done and solving these issues. And the first thing is, yes, it is to map and to measure environmental inequality. So basically, you need to know who is impacted by pollutions, who is impacted by, you know, the potential impacts of a flood, of a drought, who is impacted by COVID. And you need to do this factoring in the different dimensions of social gender, ethnic inequalities. And when you have this social map of environmental inequalities, then it's much easier to actually, you know, solve the problem, identify the victims, and provide, you know, the proper responses. And then there's another thing that is really important to do. It's also to identify who is contributing the most to these issues, to these problems. And so when doing that, you want to know which countries are polluting the most. And this is something that we know of. This is something that, you know, we've been knowing for a few decades. But something which we know less about is within nations, who actually is more responsible for climate emissions, for carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases emissions. And also the level of concentration of this responsibility in the face of pollutions. This is something we know much less about. And when we start to look into this, to dig into this, and this is what I'm doing as a researcher and what other members of the community of researchers are doing, we see a huge level of concentration of the responsibilities in terms of climate change. And we see that, you know, the top 1% of emitters at the global level are responsible for about, you know, two times the level of emissions of the entire half of the global population. And so there's a huge level of concentration. In the end, climate change is relatively, it's a highly concentrated problem. So instead of saying, you know, we're all in the same boat and everybody needs to, you know, reduce their emission, this is correct. It's a universal problem. But it also leads to perhaps more specific targeted measures on those who pollute so much, those who are very rich and those who are very wealthy. And how do they pollute a lot? Well, you know, taking planes, buying stuff, when you import stuff, when you buy stuff from China, from the rest of the world, in fact, what you're doing is that you're importing carbon. You're importing carbon that was incorporated into the production of a good. But when you're very wealthy, you also have some emissions associated to the amount of money which you have in your bank accounts. And this is something which so far has been really under the radar of public policies. This is the carbon content of financial assets, of your equities, of what's on your bank accounts. And this is extremely important to be factored in today if we really want to think social economic inequality in a way that is, you know, compatible with these other issues that we're discussing, environmental change, environmental degradation.
We'll come back to that whole issue of how and who should carbon taxes be applied to and to what degree in a minute, Lucas. But in terms of broaching the whole subject of climate change and trying not only not to widen inequalities but to narrow it, you say that when climate policies are blind to inequality concerns, they will fail. And you point to the yellow vest protests in France recently as an example of that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a perfect example of what not to do when a government tries to bring forward an environmental agenda. There are many ways to promote an environmental agenda, and some ways might actually lead to a reduction of inequalities, and other ways might actually lead to a worsening of social inequalities. In the case of the Yellow Vest movement, what was done? Well, the government introduced a carbon tax. So that's a tax on your kerosene or your fuel to go to work, for instance. And at the same time, the government reduced taxes on the very wealthy, on the financial assets owned by the very wealthy. And the French population in that case, you know, realized that at some point there were a few, you know, billion euros of extra taxes on those who had to go to work in the morning and who didn't have alternatives to, you know, putting some fuel, newly taxed fuel in their cars, and others who actually lived in big cities who don't necessarily take their cars every day and who had a massive tax reduction. So this really created a kind of important social unrest, and in the end, it led to the abandonment of the carbon tax. This is not only a French issue. You see, you know, similar picture in countries like Indonesia. In Latin America, we've seen that recently. In Nigeria, you know, protests when the price of fossil fuels are increased. And my point is that there's no fatality behind these movements. The only thing that should be done in order to avoid that is to factor in the social element when you're doing environmental policies, and to design the policy in a way that is going to reduce inequality rather than increase it. And what also strikes me as we're talking today and with this whole, you know, context of the U.S. general elections and with the state of Pennsylvania deciding the results of the election is the story about, you know, fracking and mining in Pennsylvania. And the fact that still today, so many of the coal miners and of people in the fracking industry are supportive of Donald Trump because they are afraid of green and climate policies propelled by the Democrats. And the point I'm making here is that this shouldn't be the case, because eventually, at some point, you know, not solving the climate problem is going to backfire precisely on those who are low income, precisely on these blue collar miners. But it seems to me that there's still a lot of work to be done by policymakers like the Democrats in the US to really articulate a social program with their environmental policies. This is what they've started to do with the Green New Deal agenda, for instance, but this doesn't go far enough at the moment, given the continued strong support of, you know, these mining industry people to the camp that really doesn't want to do anything at all to protect the environment.
Our guest here on News Talk is Lucas Chancel, author of Unsustainable Inequalities, Social Justice and the Environment. It sounds then, and I think most people would agree, Lucas, that in terms of very radical legislation and moves to reduce carbon emissions, and we're facing this challenge very much so here in Ireland as well, that a very clear policy of communication needs to be required for the communities that are going to be hit hard and perhaps don't understand why they're going to be hit in that way, but also pre-planning to be conscious of those social inequalities, and perhaps to give people rational alternatives or rational subsidies and benefits for choosing to go the right way, the way that we need to go.
You know, communication is always important, and indeed it's also a lot about, you know, the messaging, but it's not sufficient. You know, behind good communication, you also need good policies that really improve the lives of people. And, you know, how did the Swedes how are they able to, you know, have today the highest carbon tax rates in the world? And, you know, when they wake up in the morning, they don't say, wow, you know, these carbon tax rates are too high. This is really going to be a bad day. You know, the Swedes do not notice that their carbon tax rates are so high. Why? Well, because from the 1970s onwards, the Swedish municipalities invested massively into creating alternatives for people to be able to switch out of fossil fuels. So basically to move out of, you know, their kerosene fuel heaters at home and to use district heating, which is often heated by, you know, just recycling trees. So this is cheap source of energy. It's really efficient and it's sustainable. And it's because they have the alternatives that these people, when the carbon tax is introduced in the economy, that there's no massive social unrest. And here I want to stress the importance of, you know, government planning. And the market is very likely to not being able to address these issues, to plan, to anticipate these problems. And so this really requires investments in public services, in transportation infrastructures, in energy efficiency, that, you know, governments are a very important actor to do that. And at the end of this, you know, cycle of economic policy thinking inaugurated in the 1980s with Reagan and Thatcher, which basically says that the government should be reduced to as much as possible to just doing defense and justice, and all the rest should be left to the market. It's true that our governments are not as well equipped as we could hope they would be in order to do these investments. But this can also be seen as a chance to, you know, reopen a new, you know, cycle of economic policy thinking, where you really have these strong investments in the future that actually are going to be primarily beneficial to low and middle working and middle classes, but that eventually they also benefit the entire society, because if climate change is not addressed, everybody will be at risk.
What do you do with that enormous challenge in many parts of the emerging world, Lucas, where, you know, the likes of India and China, huge emerging middle classes that aspire to the lifestyle that the West has enjoyed for many decades, but which is largely based on a fossil fuel burning culture?
Well, the first thing is that you realize that there's no one way to develop. There's no one way to grow. First, when you compare the US and Europe, you see very different models when it comes to using carbon or to using energy with much more efficiency across European nations. So the first thing to do is really not to follow the very energy inefficient, super inefficient lifestyle of the US. But of course, Europe is in itself not a panacea. It also has to massively reduce its emissions. So to me, the real point here is that these emerging countries have to invest now into two things. First, they need to invest massively into public transportation infrastructures. And this also is about how you design cities of the future. And you need to make these cities much more efficient than American cities, how they were designed, and also more efficient than European cities. You also need to invest in public service when it comes to health and education, and there's a very important role of, you know, how you actually teach younger generations how they're going to use, you know, how they're going to relate to the environment, to use resources. But in order to be able to perform these investments, whether in infrastructure, whether in social spending, education, health, you need money. And this is what emerging countries lack. And they lack money. In fact, they don't lack it that much, because in countries like India, you have an explosion of the number and of the wealth of billionaires over the past 30 years. Even in a country like China, there's a paradox in communist China, which is the fact that its tax system is more unequal than in capitalist Hong Kong, so to say. So there really is a debate that has to be articulated in the emerging world about tax progressivity, which means that you can, you know, leave aside, you know, taxing the lower and the middle income group, and you can really increase the amount of contribution that you're asking to those very groups that have disproportionately benefited from the strong growth that was recorded in China or India over the past 30 years. And that's the top 1%, the top 5% of the population.
Easier said than done, I suppose, as you know. In terms of the West, for those who are emitting most, whether they be corporations or individuals, would you advocate perhaps something like a carbon quota, that every citizen, every individual would be given a certain amount of carbon usage as we transition out of it, and over that quota, you would be penalized heavily financially?
I think that we need to move towards solutions like this. The first step to make sure that people, you know, understand why this is done is really to make important progress in terms of the information on the carbon content of products. We're really far. We're really lagging. We live in a data-intensive world. We live in the digital age, but we're really at the prehistorical stage of our use of data for the public good, for objectives like protecting the environment or reducing inequality. So when you go to the supermarket, basically you don't really know, you know, what product contains what amount of carbon. When you're booking a flight, you know this information, but flying is not the only thing that emits CO2 emissions. If you want to invest or to save money and invest into some financial products, you have no idea what the carbon impact of these actions may be. So this really is something that you need to develop. And on the basis of this information, I also think that, yes, we need to move towards more aggressive measures, because we just don't have time. And these measures can be like carbon quotas, with a basic idea behind, which is that human beings are all equal when it comes to the amount of resources or basic resources like carbon, like fresh air, that can be used in this planet. So, you know, rather than having a, you know, chaotic world, economies that face an exacerbation of social tensions because of an increasing number of, you know, climate shocks, I think it's preferable to organize this democratically based on good information, based on planned reduction of energy needs, using quotas if necessary. And by the way, quotas can create some anxiety across, you know, a lot of people. But at the same time, they are already used when it comes to managing environmental resources in many places, in many democratic countries. When it comes to water, for instance, there are a lot of quotas associated to the use of water or other forms of energy at the local level. And I think that, yes, this could and this has to be extended at some point of time, the sooner the better, when it comes to carbon and to energy.
Radical change is definitely needed ahead, and your book is a very important and timely contribution to the whole debate, but we'll leave it there. That's Lucas Chancel, co-director of the World Inequality Lab at the Paris School of Economics and author of Unsustainable Inequalities, Social Justice and the Environment. Lucas, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll hear next from Daniel Yergin, the Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and Clash of Nations. Daniel, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Now, it's a fascinating book, and I suppose one of the key messages from it is that while there are political lines and boundaries on the map, the global map, and most of those haven't changed since the fall of the Soviet Union 30, 40 years ago, there's a different map, and it's delineated by changing power relationships and dependencies, and they're shaped in many occasions by energy resources and requirements.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, what I've tried to do with calling the book The New Map was a sense that there is a new map of both energy and geopolitics, and those two things are interacting, ranging from, you know, the change in the position of the United States to climate to changing relations with China.
China is a key factor in this new 21st century map, Daniel, not just because it is rapidly becoming the world's biggest economy with huge energy needs, but also because it's very sensitive to the fact that it's vulnerable on its energy requirements and in many ways is stretching out beyond its borders to try to reduce that vulnerability while also trying to increase its own renewable resources within.
Yes, you're speaking about China, and China has the growth of the Chinese economy has taken it from being self-sufficient in oil to being basically dependent for 75% of its oil on imports, many of which come through the South China Sea, which is a very controversial body of water. But China is also at the same time is pushing renewables. Half the wind in the world, half the solar in the world is in China. And in a sense, for China, energy is about everything, but it wants to reduce its dependence on coal, which is now almost 60% of its total energy and is really an inheritance of decades and decades of central planning.
And do you believe that this view of its energy requirements over the decades ahead is dictating to some degree its diplomatic and geopolitical strategies, not just the Belt and Road, where it's investing in other countries to get port infrastructure, the likes of that, but also its very aggressive attitude to the South China Sea and the Key Magellan Straits?
Yeah, I think that China has both major economic objectives and major geopolitical objectives. And with what is called its Belt and Road strategy, which is this notion of connecting Central Asia, South Asia, Africa, and Europe with the Chinese economy, certainly has a major political dimension about its role in the world. And it's adopted a very strong position on the South China Sea, claiming that body of water through which passes one-third of world trade every day, claiming it as its own, and the other nations around there, and the United States, and Britain, and Australia, don't accept that at all. So, and of course, it's changed the position of Hong Kong. So you kind of see a kind of polarization developing, very different from 5 or 6 years ago, when it seemed that that people talked about China being integrated into a global community. Now it's almost as though maybe two global communities are emerging.
Another key factor in this new map that you sketch out, that's evolving all the time, of course, starts from a very remote location in a small town in Texas, and how that has changed the geopolitical and energy needs of the United States.
Well, it is remarkable. You know, sometimes, Vincent, come from big forces and big organizations, and sometimes it just comes from stubborn individuals. And there was one stubborn individual named George Mitchell, who was not an oil man, he was a gas man, and he believed that you could get natural gas out of this very dense rock called shale. And everybody said, you're crazy, you're wasting your money. The textbooks say it's impossible. And he stuck at it for 18 years. And after 18 years, in this little town called Dish, Texas, population a few hundred, the first shale well was drilled, and everybody thought it was a joke and not amount to anything. But you know what? It really changed the energy world, because the United States, which had imported 60% of its oil, which was the world's largest importer of oil, instead became and has become the world's largest producer of oil. And suddenly it produces more oil than Russia and produces more oil than Saudi Arabia. And that really changes the global energy markets. And I think, again, going to your earlier comments, Vincent, changes geopolitics.
And in many ways, it changes geopolitics, Daniel, in the sense that dependencies change. So because the U.S. has become, in a way, much more self-sufficient for its oil and gas needs, it may over time become less sensitive to what happens politically in the Middle East. And that has all sorts of ramifications as well.
Yeah, well, I think that is very much on the minds of some of the Gulf countries. Right now, you wouldn't see it because of the tension involved with Iran and its nuclear program. But I think that the countries in the region worry about that. I think it's one of the factors in this kind of astonishing thing in which the United Arab Emirates, one of the major oil producers, one of the major Gulf countries, along with Bahrain, now has a peace treaty with Israel, which would have been unthinkable, say, 4 months ago, would not have been expected. So that's, I think, one consequence, that saying, you know, that these countries have to be more cooperative with each other to deal with the other threats in the region, as well as the economic opportunities. But I think it is, you know, it is different. And even you see Saudi Arabia, which, you know, has been one of America's most important allies in the Middle East, one of its two major allies, has also developed a new relationship with a surprising partner called Russia and Vladimir Putin. I have a wonderful picture in the book of Vladimir Putin visiting with the king of Saudi Arabia and giving him a huge Arctic falcon, which is, you know, they love falconry in the Arab world, and as kind of a symbol of their partnership.
And Russia itself remains a key player as we head into the 21st century, Daniel, in the sense that it's a relatively small economy, but it's a nuclear power still, obviously, but also a huge petrol or gas station, if you will, supplying a huge amount of Europe's gas needs, and increasingly, and here's another power play at work, increasingly supplying China's gas needs.
Yes, it's you're so right, Vincent, to note that sometimes one forgets that this Russian economy is only slightly bigger than that of Spain, and Spain ceased being a great power in the 18th century. And yet Vladimir Putin, the skillful judo player, as I call him, or judoist, he plays judo rather than chess in international politics, has put Russia back as a great power. And right now, huge controversy surrounding Russian gas exports to Europe, and in particular, a pipeline called Nord Stream 2, which runs under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany, 3 weeks from being completed, and U.S. sanctions have kind of stopped it from being completed. But at the same time that those sanctions went into effect, Vladimir Putin and his self-described best friend, Xi Jinping, the president of China, had this elaborate ceremony in different parts of Russia and China where they pulled the switch to start the flow of natural gas through this huge pipeline called the Power of Siberia. And I think that energy element is very important element. It's not the whole thing in this kind of growing alliance between Russia and China. And, you know, I've seen it up close when I was in St. Petersburg, and there was a program with President Putin and President Xi, and President Putin apologized to President Xi, said, I'm sorry I kept you talking up till 4 a.m. in the morning, your time talking. And she said, we never have enough time to talk. So those two guys and those two countries have really gotten together, and that's a very geopolitical significance. If I could just say, Vincent, one of the great pictures in the book shows Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, the president of China, making Russian pancakes. And Putin is explaining to Xi how you make Russian pancakes, which are called blini. And of course, while they were cooking up the pancakes, they were also cooking up other things. Chinese troops, for the first time, were participating in a massive Russian energy military exercise, which kind of all symbolized this shifting balance of power that you've been talking about in the world.
Our guest here on News Talk is Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and Clash of Nations. Now, I suppose one of the other key factors in this evolving world, Daniel, that may actually change these relationships again and perhaps reduce some of the geopolitical sensitivities is if the world can develop more renewable energy and become less dependent on traditional fossil fuels of oil and gas. And we've seen China very recently surprise the world by saying it has now set a target for being carbon neutral by 2060, which would be both an amazing achievement in its own right, but also perhaps change those relationships with Russia and perhaps make it less
sensitive.
Well,
that was a very dramatic statement that President Xi made. He did it at the United Nations. I think it was also a very deliberate geopolitical point of view, because China is seeking to say, oh, we're the leader of globalization, we're the leader of the global community, rather than what has been the Trump administration, which is, you know, America first, we're going to go it alone, and particularly wrapping itself around climate. But I think for China, climate is not only about climate in the sense we think about it in Europe or in Ireland or in the United States, but it's also about urban pollution, which is a huge problem in China. And so addressing climate is also a way to address urban pollution. And I think there's no question that renewables is a growing business, and many utilities are aiming to be, by 2035 or 2050, net carbon zero. And indeed, that's the objective of the new president of the European Union. So I think we're going to see a lot more spending and development of renewables. So that will change the energy mix over time. And so one country that would be a big winner from that happens to be China, because 70% of solar panels are made in China and another 10% by Chinese companies elsewhere. They dominate what's called the lithium-ion battery supply chain, which you need for electric cars, rare earths, and so forth. So China is kind of well-positioned to take advantage of the shift to renewables.
So at one level, if China is serious, and we know being an autocracy, it can do what it requires to do to meet targets. If it's serious about these targets and a Biden administration changes the United States' view on the Paris Accord and signs up to it, perhaps renewable energy and even power sources like hydrogen could become a much more significant factor in this global mix and perhaps make the dependence on fossil fuels almost redundant within the next 20 years.
Well, I don't think redundant. I think for, you know, like in the United States, the average car stays on the road for 12 years. So I think it's going to be a more mixed picture. We'll have a lot more renewables. I think hydrogen, a lot of interest in hydrogen. I think it's still early stage, but, you know, I've just noticed every company that one runs into is now looking at hydrogen and saying what role, but it would take 10 or 20 years to unfold that. But I think there's no question, would you say, that President Biden would immediately rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. And he has a $2 trillion climate plan. So you would see an acceleration of renewables. So the mix will change and there'll be more renewables. But remember, wind and solar, you know, you can't put that into your petrol tank, your gasoline tank. So that is really replacing coal and competing with natural gas for power generation, and nuclear, where they're still building nuclear.
Leaving the very urgent environmental targets that we should try to achieve, Daniel, you seem to think that this transition from fossil fuels is going to take longer than perhaps it should, but in reality, it will.
If I can say, Vince, I think one other part of it, if I can just jump in here, is that one part of what we're going to need, I mean, I really think the answers are technology, with a colleague, former Energy Secretary Moniz, did a study for Bill Gates Foundation about all the technologies we don't have that we need. And one part of the technology we need is what's called carbon capture, because if we are continuing to use oil and gas, we're going to have to find ways to capture and even use the carbon. And so, you know, the real answers here are going to come out of technology that will kind of get us to where we all want to go.
You could argue as well, Daniel, that one of the key resources that could cause huge geopolitical shifts through the 21st century and that could cause many, many tensions and already beginning to do so is actually water.
Yes. I mean, people point to water and particularly desertification and the impacts that has on migration. If you think about people coming from, you know, Africa into Europe and so forth. But, you know, I don't see water as a source of regional conflict, like Ethiopia versus Egypt right now. I don't see it as I see water as a problem, but I don't see it as a sort of global conflictual problem because of its local and regional nature.
Are you basically optimistic as we head into the third decade of the 21st century? Because you say that we'll still be extracting large quantities of fossil fuels for decades to power the world's economies, and we possibly will go to war over them. And we know in the 21st century, if wars start for resources, they could get out of hand very quickly.
Well, I do worry. I mean, by nature, I'm an optimist, and I do think that, you know, in the conclusion of the new map, I go through all of this amazing surprises that have happened in the last 10 or 12 years, from shale to the falling costs of solar to financial crisis to the impact of the Paris Climate Agreement, and of course, COVID on top of it all. You go through the list, but I see two big issues that we'll be dealing with in the decades ahead. One is climate, and the other is what I call this clash of nations, and in particular, worry about the prudent management of relations with China, both by the U.S. and by Europe. But I am also struck that, you know, technology and innovation responds to need. I'm on the advisory board at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative, and I'm just amazed by the amount of incredible creativity and scientific ingenuity that's going into trying to address climate. So I think we will, there will be solutions that we need that will work at scale, but they'll take time to unfold. But I think that's where the true emphasis needs to be. U.S. Department of Energy spends $6.5 billion a year on basic science, and you build it up from basic science. So that's why I'm an optimist, because, you know, energy has been in transition since 1709, since an iron metal worker in Shropshire in England figured out how to use coal instead of wood to make better iron, and it's been evolving since. And I think we're going to see an acceleration. We're living in acceleration of the energy transition.
And I'm glad to hear that you are optimistic, broadly speaking, about the years ahead. I might conclude by, you do feel that we are at a very challenging point in terms of the changing relationship between the United States and China, the dominant player, and I suppose the key challenger, almost like Britain and Germany before the First World War. And we all need to work hard to make sure that same outcome doesn't ensue.
I think that's so true, Vincent, that when I hear people talk about great power competition and strategic rivalry, it really does echo of that decade before the First World War, which the world stumbled into by accident. And so I think what you have emphasized is a central point, which is the prudent, stable, predictable management of relations and not have volatility in it, and find areas where you can work together, like climate, and avoid getting into a spiral where, you know, it becomes tit for tat and you lose that ability to come together. And, you know, and we are very knit together as a world, and sometimes we have to remember that and work together. So I think I think that's going to be, there's a new administration in the United States in January. I think the top issue is going to be how to manage prudently relations with China. And that applies to Europe as well. I think we need countries working together rather than going it alone.
And basically focusing on providing sufficient energy needs as well, so that that doesn't become the spark. A fascinating topic over the years ahead, but we'll leave it there. That's Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and Clash of Nations. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.